So it's great pleasure to have Mike Comerly as today's speaker. So as many of you know already, Mike has done a lot of interesting works on quantum spin liquids and fracton physics and cold atoms and generally symmetric fractionalization. And today we will hear about subsystem symmetric fractionalization. Okay, Mike.
All right, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to speak in this seminar series. It would only be a greater pleasure to be there in person at Perimeter, of course, but this is still pretty good. So what I wanna tell you about today is a piece of work. It sort of goes under the topic of fracton physics. It's really a sort of very simple version of fracton-like physics that can occur in two-dimensional systems with certain kinds of symmetries called subsystem symmetries. And so this work is on the archive. You can read about it here. And these are my collaborators, in particular, David Stephen, who's a postdoc at Boulder, also with the joint affiliation with Caltech. He's really been the driving force behind this work. But there have also been really many great contributions from my other collaborators. It's really been a fun and ongoing collaboration, which is now moving in some directions that are a bit different than what I'll be able to talk about today. And so the other collaborators are Arpit Dua, Jose Gare Rubio, and Dominic Williamson. Motivation that we can start with is a pretty general question, right? So suppose we have a topologically ordered phase or a fracton phase. The whole talk will be about gapped states. So everything is gapped. But I mean a gapped phase which has some non-trivial excitations in the bulk. Okay, so in 2D, you can think of anion excitations. In 3D, you can think of the excitations that carry the gauge charge of a deconfined gauge theory like Z2 gauge theory. And there can also be line excitations or membrane excitations if you go to even higher dimensions. But there should be some non-trivial excitations in the bulk that have some kind of non-trivial braiding with other excitations. Okay. Those are the kind of phases that I'm thinking about. So even in the absence of any symmetry, these are already non-trivial and interesting phases. And then the question is, if we have some kind of symmetry, how does this already non-trivial physics get enriched? Here I've made this table, which I could actually make bigger. This is this maybe one of the simplest versions of this table that I could draw. Since this topic is related to fracton physics, even before we have any symmetry, we could have topological order. So that would be something like a theory of anions in 2D, like a fractional quantum Hall state or a gapped spin liquid. But when you go to three dimensions and higher, we can also have fracton order. So those would be states where there are gapped excitations of restricted mobility, for which there's no local process that can take an isolated excitation and move it somewhere else in the system, okay? Or maybe those excitations can only move along lines or within planes or something like that, okay? And then you can also ask about different types of symmetry. So the simplest thing to ask about which is the left-hand side of the table, is just what I'll refer to as a global symmetry in this talk. And in this talk, global symmetry is just shorthand for an internal symmetry. So it's not a spatial symmetry. It doesn't move things around in space. Think of it just like a spin rotation. Okay, it acts on every spin individually, doesn't move the spins around. And it's also going to be, for this talk, it's going to be always a unitary symmetry. Okay, so it won't be something like time reversal. Okay, so we can think about global symmetries. And there are many other kinds of symmetries we can think about. I mentioned crystalline symmetries, but in this talk, the kind of symmetry that I'll want to focus on are what's called subsystem symmetries. And I'll review those in a minute if you don't know what that is. So don't worry about that yet. In this table, this lower left quadrant, has been explored a lot. There have been a large number of works in the lower left quadrant, topologically ordered phases with global symmetries. And that goes under the heading of what's often called symmetry-enriched topological phases. So a lot's known down here. In the other three boxes, much less is known, although there have been some works exploring each of these quadrants. And it's probably fair to say that in this talk, I'm going to focus on topologically ordered phases. So there won't be any fracton order. And these phases will have subsystem symmetries. Okay, so it's this lower right box in the quadrant. And what's contained in this box are what you might call subsystem SET phases. So they're symmetry enriched topological phases, but where the symmetry is a subsystem symmetry. And I think it's fair to say that this is the quadrant of this table that's been the least explored. For some reasons that will become clear in a second. I don't think that there's not really a systematic understanding of any of these quadrants, except for this one, where there is actually a pretty good degree of systematic understanding, especially in two dimensions. Okay, so this is mostly what I'm gonna focus on, but first I wanna give a little bit more review and introduction. I wanna say a few things about SET phases, which will then motivate studying these subsystem symmetry enriched phases. Okay, so the kind of simplest and one of the most important phenomena that occur in SET phases is just the phenomenon of fractional quantum numbers, and so that goes back a long time. It goes back to Laughlin's original paper on the fractional quantum Hall effect. Where it was pointed out that what we now call Laughlin quasi-particles carry fractions of the electron charge. So that's an example of this phenomenon. Let me tell you about an example, which is, I'm not sure if it's simpler, but it's in the context of examples that will be much more closely related to the examples I'll be talking about later in this talk. So let's imagine that we have the topological order of the 2D toric code model, okay, which I don't need to write down the model, at least not yet for these purposes. The important thing to know is that there are four kinds of excitations in the toric code. There are trivial excitations, which are just excitations that you can make locally by flipping some finite number of spins. And then there are two different kinds of bosonic excitations, but nonetheless, they're non-trivial because you can't make a single one of them locally. And usually we call these E and M. Here we're thinking about the charges and fluxes of Z2 gauge theory here, where usually we'd think of E as a charge and M as a flux, so electric and magnetic excitations. And even though these excitations have bosonic self-statistics, if you bring an E all the way around an M, you pick up a pi Aronoff-Bohm phase. Okay, so there's some non-trivial mutual statistics. And because of that mutual statistics, if you put an E and an M together, you make a composite excitation, which is usually called epsilon, and that excitation has fermionic self-statistics. Okay, so that's the theory of anions for the toric code. It describes its topological order. So what happens if we add a symmetry? So we think of a toric code type model with a symmetry. Let's think about the simplest possible thing. We'll just add a Ising symmetry, Z2 global symmetry. We're called the non-trivial element of the Z2A. Okay, so any trivial excitation, any excitation you make locally, it just has to, if you look at eigenstates of the symmetry, then trivial excitations can either be charged or neutral under the Z2, and charged means that they have a eigenvalue of -1, and those are the only two possibilities for trivial excitations. But these non-trivial anions like E and M or epsilon, it's possible, depending on the model, for those excitations to have symmetry eigenvalues of plus or minus I, and you should really think of that as carrying a half charge. And a sign of this is that if you take U of A and square it, this has to give you the identity operator on trivial excitations, okay, because a squared equals 1 in the Z2 group. But there's a sense in which the symmetry operator squared actually can act as -1 on some of the anion excitations. And I'll review that in more detail later because we'll need to understand what that statement really means in order to talk about subsystem symmetry fractionalization. Another thing that can happen and it can happen in models of this kind, is that the symmetry can permute anions of different types. And in this model, the only possible permutation is that E's and M's can get exchanged. Okay. So this phenomenon is something that I won't be focusing on this talk, and actually, you'll see maybe why a little bit later on. But for the most part, this talk is more about fractional quantum numbers associated with symmetry. That's what it's going to be about, but it's going to be about a version of that that only occurs with subsystem symmetry. So it's a little bit less familiar. Okay, so what are subsystem symmetries? So these are symmetries that act on some rigid subspaces of space. So like imagine you have a 3D system, you could have symmetries acting only on the spins within some line or within some plane or even living on a fractal subspace, okay? So what does it mean the symmetry only acts on these rigid subspaces? It means, for example, you would have something like an Ising model on a cubic lattice, and you might have symmetries that flip all the spins on a plane one at a time. So it's kind of in the direction of a local symmetry, but it's not a completely local symmetry where you can do something individually on every lattice site. And I should mention that this is distinct from, there are some connections, but this is distinct from what are called higher form symmetries, which in a lattice model Hamiltonian setup also act on some subspaces of space. But with higher form symmetries, you can act on some flexible or bendable subspaces of space. So you might have symmetry operators that act on lines, but actually would really be your symmetries would act on curves, which can be deformed arbitrarily. And that can be defined even on a lattice. But in subsystem symmetry, you might have symmetries acting on lines, but the lines can't bend. So they're really the lines on which the symmetry acts are rigid. Okay, so why would we care about such symmetries? It's certainly true from a standard condensed matter physics point of view that you're not going to have these symmetries without some fine tuning. However, they could exist as approximate symmetries in some models. And in fact, it's reasonable. There are even some situations in solids where symmetries like this might exist as approximate symmetries. It's not very well explored. And certainly in engineered quantum systems that you might make, for example, in an optical tweezer array or something like that, you could imagine engineering a model that has symmetries like this to a reasonable approximation. Okay, so those, so you might imagine that you can have systems where these symmetries do actually play a role. There's a more formal reason to be interested in symmetries like this too, which is that in three dimensions and higher, if you have a system with subsystem symmetries and then you gauge those symmetries, you couple them to some kind of generalized gauge field, that actually leads to models with fracton order. And so phases with systems with subsystem symmetry are sort of the ungauged versions of fracton phases. And so that's a reason, a formal reason that it's important to study these symmetries. But I think there are also physical reasons. So if you do study systems with subsystem symmetry, one thing that's received a lot of attention is that there are generalizations of symmetry protected topological phases, which are called SSPT phases. And just like SPT phases, these are relatively boring in the bulk, but they have interesting phenomena on spatial boundaries. Okay, you can have gapless modes of various kinds on the boundaries protected by subsystem symmetry. And one of the reasons that subsystem symmetry, that SSPT phases are interesting, it's been pointed out that they're a useful resource for measurement-based quantum computation. And so there's been a lot of interest in such phases recently, coming more from the quantum information side of the field, and in particular from people thinking about measurement-based quantum computing.
Question?
Okay, yeah.
So for this measurement-based quantum computation, is it the phase or is it some particular state that's the resource?
Yeah, so, right. I mean, so that's been part of the developing story. So I'm not an expert in this, but in fact, if you look at the two references that I gave, so it was known for a rather long time that a state called the 2D cluster state is a resource for measurement-based quantum computing. And so that was shown by ELSE and collaborators even back in 2012. And it was an open question whether that property persists to a whole phase. And I think part of the question is to define what you mean by a phase. So if you impose a subsystem symmetry, which is just in that case, line-like subsystem symmetries, then it was proved in this later paper by Rausendorf et al. I forget exactly what year that is, but it's within the last few years, that actually there's an entire SSPT phase that has the same, you know, it's a resource for MBQC in the same sense. So that property persists throughout the phase. So at least in that case, it's proved that, you know, there's a whole phase, which, you know, the title of their paper is a computationally universal phase of matter, because unlike in 1D SPT phases, in a 2D SSPT phase, it's possible to implement the scheme for universal quantum computation. And actually, I should also mention, because I think it's often that work by Rausendorf et al. Is not really properly cited in the condensed matter community. That's actually the first work that I know of where the existence of an SSPT phase was pointed out. It was actually on the archive before, for example, this paper by EGO and others, which is also a very nice paper, which is often the people that in condensed matter people cite as the first paper for SSPT phases.
Thank you.
All right. So, okay. Good. Right. So, but in this talk, I want to talk about what I would. I don't want to talk about SSPT phases, so I'd like there to be some topological order. And really the simplest case, I want to talk about the simplest case for that you can imagine, which is a 2D topologically ordered phase. So that's the lowest dimension where we can have topological order in the sense that I mean it with a subsystem symmetry. And of course, this is also related to SSPT phases because there are ungauged versions of these SSPT phases if they exist. And the SSPT phases that these states would be related to would have both subsystem and a global symmetry. And there would have to be some non-trivial interplay between those two symmetries. The idea is you'd get to the symmetry enriched phase by gauging the global symmetry. So you'd have a rather conventional gauge theory, but then with some subsystem symmetry. But those SSPT phases have also not, just like the SSET phases I'm telling you about haven't really been explored, these mixed SSPT phases with both gauge and global symmetry, for the most part, have not really been explored. Okay. Another thing this is connected to in higher dimensions, not in two dimensions, this is also related to systems that have both topological order and fracton order. And so that's something that's received some attention over the past couple of years. And you know, what kind of phenomena come out, right? Is there some interesting phenomenon that comes out of all of this? And there is, and I'll get to it around the end of the talk. So non-trivial SSET phases, have interesting mobility restrictions, and they're mobility restrictions that you get if you enforce the symmetry, okay? So the excitations, the anyon excitations of the topological order will generally have restricted mobility, but only if you look at dynamics that preserves the symmetry, preserves the subsystem symmetry. Okay, so there has been some prior work on 2D SSET phases, actually by my collaborators before I started thinking about this problem. And one of the things they did is they came up with a sort of a no-go argument, and it's important to review what that argument says. Okay, so the idea in cartoon pictures is that if you have a subsystem symmetry that acts on a line in space, and you have some mobile point particles, which here I'm calling A and A bar, well, if they're mobile, there's some process by which you can move one of these particles off the line. Okay, and if you compare these two situations, what you wind up concluding is that this subsystem symmetry S actually cannot be fractionalized on one of these mobile point particles. So it has to act, this symmetry S has to act on A as it would on a trivial excitation. Okay, and so from this, they concluded that actually There is no subsystem symmetry fractionalization on mobile point-like excitations. Now, obviously, that's not all there is to the story, because there otherwise there would be nothing for me to give my talk about. And so one thing that I'll do in this talk is give a refined argument that shows that indeed certain kinds of subsystem symmetry fractionalization are ruled out on point mobile point particles. And those are the only kinds of excitations that we'll have in 2D, but not everything is ruled out. There will be certain things that are not ruled out and that are a little bit too subtle for this kind of cartoonish argument to capture them, okay? So this is far from the only thing that they did in their paper. In fact, most of what their paper is about, motivated by this no-go argument, is they looked at three-dimensional topologically ordered states, which have loop excitations, and they looked at non-trivial actions of subsystem symmetry on those loop excitations. Okay, but in this talk, I'm gonna stick to the simpler case of 2D and basically find a way around this no-go argument by refining it. So in order to do that, here's the outline of the rest of the talk. I wanna start by just reviewing fractionalization of ordinary global symmetries in two dimensions. And I'll review it in a, that's a story that's been around for quite some time now. It's, you know, been understood, I would say, in its modern form now for about 10 years, maybe a little bit less than that. So I'll give a particular account of that story, which I'm not sure has really appeared anywhere in the literature in exactly this form. But there's not really anything new there. It's just a version of that story which is suitable for applying to subsystem symmetries. And so then that's what I'll do in the next part. And then at the end, I'll illustrate how to apply that framework in the context of a simple solvable model. Okay, so, all right. So we wanna think about, so we wanna think about 2D lattice models and I'll restrict for simplicity to systems that only have bosonic degrees of freedom, so like spin models, and we'll assume that our systems are gapped. And we would like there to be some non-trivial topological order, so there are anyon excitations, but we don't want to assume anything about the topological order, so in particular, it doesn't have to be abelian, it could be some non-abelian topological order. Okay. We need to put some symmetry into the story, so we'll suppose we have a global symmetry G, which we'll assume is unitary, so no time reversal. And to keep things simple, I'll assume that G is a finite group, although that assumption can be relaxed. The symmetry will be represented in the physical system by symmetry operators U of G that are just products of on-site unitary operators. Okay, and I'm gonna make a further assumption, which is that symmetry does not permute anyon type. So we'll have nothing like this E to M exchange that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. Okay, that's for simplicity, but also both because you'll see we won't have to worry about those sort of phenomena for subsystem symmetry. Now in order to start talking about symmetry fractionalization, the first thing I wanna do is choose some region of space, which is gonna be some fixed region. It'll be shaped like a disk and I want it to be large, very large compared to the correlation length of the system. And these circles are supposed to be excitations. So here there are a few excitations sitting inside this region. There are some excitations sitting outside this region. The reason that we're interested in fixing a region is that we would like to be able to talk about the action of symmetry just inside this region. And then eventually that will let us talk about the action of symmetry just on a single anyon, which is located inside this region. And it's tricky to do that without fixing a region because, for example, if you work in finite volume in a space with periodic boundaries, then you can't have just a single anyon. That's not possible. Its antiparticle would have to sit somewhere else. And so this idea of a local symmetry action, or what we'll call a localized version of the symmetry, is going to play an important role. Okay, so what we want to do, so I want to define what I'll call a set of localizable states on this region R, okay? And a localizable state on R is just something that looks locally like the ground state within this thickened boundary of R. Okay, so there are no excitations sitting within the boundary del R. And a little bit more precisely, if you look at a small disk anywhere within del R, then the local density matrix of that disk should be the same as the density matrix of a ground state. Okay. All right, so, but we're allowed to have stuff deep in the bulk of this region R, and we're allowed to have excitations, and we're allowed to have excitations outside the region R, just not within this thickened boundary region. Okay, so now what are we gonna use this region to do? So we'll use it to construct localized versions of the symmetry operators. So we start with a symmetry operator U of G, which is supported throughout space. Okay, it's represented by this green shading. So that's supposed to extend to infinity. And then the first thing we do is we just truncate it. So we throw away all the on-site unitaries that act outside R, and we get some truncated version of the symmetry. And that's a very naive truncation. It's the simplest thing you could do. And in general, if you take an operator like that and act on, say, a ground state, you will create excitations inside that boundary region. You'll create a bunch of garbage on the boundary. Okay, so if you act with this truncated operator on a localizable state, you will not get back a localizable state. You'll get a state with some garbage around the boundary. Okay, but the idea is that we would like to have a version of the symmetry that takes a localizable state to another localizable state. So we would like to not create excitations in this boundary region. And what we assume is that it's possible to modify this operator just on the boundary. So for example, you know, the idea is you take a product of this truncated operator with, say, a finite depth quantum circuit, which is just supported on the boundary. And that gives you a localized operator that doesn't create any excitations in this boundary region. So the idea is, the assumption is, that it's possible to, whatever garbage you created on the boundary with this truncated symmetry operator, it's possible to clean that up locally and go back to a ground state by applying some appropriate operator. Okay. Now, there are situations where these localized versions of the symmetry definitely don't exist. So if the symmetry is spontaneously broken, you can't construct an operator like this because acting with the truncated symmetry puts in a domain wall, and there's no way to destroy a domain wall just by acting with an operator supported along the length of the domain wall. Another situation where this doesn't work is if the symmetry permutes anyon types, because if you have a symmetry that turns an E into an M, there's no way to do that with a local operator. There's no way to turn an E into an M without creating some excitation somewhere else with an operator just supported on a finite patch. Okay, however, it's believed that if the symmetry is unbroken and if it doesn't permute anyons in a gapped state, then operators like this always exist. In solvable models, it's generally possible to construct them explicitly. It's certainly not proved that you can always do a construction like this, but it's believed that you always can. Okay. All right. So now, once we have these localized symmetry operators, what can we do with them? Well, we can study their action on single anyon excitations. And another thing that we can do is we can extract from them some algebraic data that characterizes what kind of fractional quantum numbers we have, or what kind of symmetry fractionalization we have. And the way to do that is you just ask what happens when you multiply two of these operators. And because these operators got modified on their boundary, they don't quite form a representation of the group, and they wind up being off from a representation of the group by some operator omega that's just supported on the boundary del R. Okay, if omega is anything interesting, it should be somehow tied to the underlying topological order. And so the only interesting kind of operator that omega can really be is an operator for an anyon string around del R. So it would be an operator that you can think of it as a process that creates an anyon and an anti-anyon and drags them around the boundary region and then re-annihilates them. Okay, you can also argue that it has to be an abelian anyon string. There may be non-abelian anyons in the theory, but there will generally be some, well, there's always some subgroup of abelian anyons, which may be trivial, but omega can only be a string operator in this subgroup of abelian anyons. And there's an algebraic constraint on omega, It really just comes from associativity. So omega obeys some equation like this. So it's not some completely arbitrary operator. It obeys this, what's called a two co-cycle condition. And there's also an ambiguity in omega because each of these localized versions of the symmetry, we're completely free to modify it by multiplying it with an abelian anion string operator on the boundary, because this operator and this operator that's modified with that string are both perfectly good localizations of the symmetry G. And that does not leave omega invariant, it changes it in this way. And so whatever interesting data is sitting there in omega should be data that is left invariant under these transformations. And so we just look at equivalence classes of omegas that don't change under this kind of transformation. And mathematically, those equivalence classes are cohomology classes, and they live in a certain cohomology group where the group G here is the symmetry and script A is the fusion group of abelian anions in the theory. So for example, in the toric code, this script A would be Z2 cross Z2. It's generated by the E and M anions. Okay, so the important thing about this, part of the story is that, from these string operators that sit on the boundary, we can tell what kind of symmetry fractionalization we have. And for a given group G and theory of anions, the different possibilities for a type of symmetry fractionalization are just elements of this group. Okay. Now, when we talk about subsystem symmetries in just a second, it's really helpful to think about our symmetry group in terms of generators and relations, because subsystem symmetry groups are much, much easier to describe in that way, because they're kind of large symmetry groups. And of course, any group can be described in terms of generators and relations. It's actually, even just to understand what all of this means physically, it's sort of helpful to see how that works in this simple setting. So suppose that we have a bunch of generators, Si, and then some relations among them. So the relations would just be products of generators and maybe products of their inverses. And they're just some products of generators that are equal to one in the symmetry group. So that's what I mean when I say I have a relation R. And so for every relation R, what we can do is we can take a product of all of these localized symmetry operators for the generators. And we can think of that as a localized version of the relation acting on this region R. But in the interior of the region, this localized relation has to look like the identity. Because if you take these generators and take their product in the group, that is the identity. But because all these operators got modified on the boundary, some non-trivial anion string could be left behind, okay? And so that just depends on which relation you looked at. So I'll call that string phi of R. It just depends on what relation we looked at. It's some abelian anion. Physically, what this phi of R tells us is just how the relation acts projectively on a single anion within R, okay? So here we have an A anion, and we have this phi of R anion string. And if that's the state that we start with the A anion, we can act with this localized version of the relation. And what we wind up with is just a phase factor, which comes from the mutual statistics between the phi of R anion string and the A anion. And that gives us this phase factor here. So in the example that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, I said that you can, if you have a Z2 symmetry, that can act on a toric code E particle. There's a sense in which the symmetry squared gives you -1 acting on an E particle in the toric code. So that -1 is exactly this phase. And the way that you would get that is if this is the string operator of an M particle, because then M and E have a pi mutual statistic. So if you have an E sitting inside and an M string here, then you'd get a minus sign here. Okay. All right, so now that's enough. I've told you enough about what we need to know about this old story about fractionalization of ordinary global symmetries in two-dimensional topological orders. So now we can generalize this to subsystem symmetries, okay? And when the story is set up in this way, it's pretty clear what to do. Okay, and rather than trying to talk about all possible subsystem symmetries in general, which would be cumbersome, we'll just talk. I'll tell you about a particular symmetry, and it's not very hard to think about how you generalize this to other symmetries once you know this one example. Okay, and so what symmetry do I want to focus on? So this is what we would call a linear Z2 subsystem symmetry. And it acts on perpendicular rows and columns. So there are two kinds of generators. This is a row generator, okay, call it Xj. J is the vertical coordinate. Here's a column generator, Yi. Here's the horizontal coordinate, I. So in a spin model, this row generator would, for example, do something to every spin in a given row, but it would not touch the spins elsewhere in the system. So these generators obey a whole bunch of relations. And the first one here just says that this is a Z2 symmetry. So all the generators square to one. Okay. So on every row and column, we have a Z2 symmetry. And these next three relations just say that any pair of generators commutes. Okay. Both generators running in the same direction and perpendicular generators. So it's a completely abelian symmetry. And finally, there's one more interesting relation, which I'll call it a global relation because it involves the symmetries acting everywhere in space. And what this relation says is that if you take a product of all the row generators, that's equal to a product of all the column generators. Now, that didn't have to be the case. We could have stopped with just these relations. Although if you stop with just these relations, there's sort of nothing that ties the row and column generators together. The symmetry is really just a product. So this relation ties the row and column symmetries together in some interesting way. But the symmetry with and without this, you know, the right way to think about it is that we could have a subsystem symmetry with only these relations, or we could have the one that I'm talking about with the global relation, and they're just different subsystem symmetries. So you can talk about models with one symmetry or with the other symmetry. It turns out that nothing interesting will happen for our purposes unless we have this global relation. So I'd like to have it, and you'll see why that is. And in a little bit, we'll meet a spin model that that has a symmetry which has this global relation. Okay, so now what we should do is we should just think about constructing localized versions of each of the, let's say, row and column symmetries, okay? So that kind of works. It starts in the same way. We'd have one of our row symmetries. We truncate it to some region R. And, you know, we only cut this symmetry operator in these two small regions. We only cut it at two points. And so in order to construct the localized version of the symmetry, so this truncated symmetry operator will create some garbage in the boundary of del R like before, but it's only going to create garbage at these two points by locality. And so the assumption is now that in order for a localization to exist, what we mean is that we can locally clean up that garbage that got created by modifying the truncated operator around this point and around this point, but not elsewhere around the boundary of del R. Now you could imagine modifying it by running a string from here to here or something like that, but that's a kind of unappealing and not very reasonable thing to do because it actually would change the support of the operator. And we don't want to do that. So we want to preserve the support of this truncated operator. And so that's only possible if we can clean up whatever excitations are created by making these local modifications. Okay. Right. And in fact, another way of understanding why you make that assumption is that you actually don't get a well-defined action of the symmetries on anions that sit inside the region unless you make that assumption. So that's a little bit of a subtle point that I can come back to maybe at the end if there are questions. There's a completely analogous story for column generators. You just rotate this picture by 90 degrees. And what I want to say for now about this is just that we assume that localizations of the symmetry like this exist. Okay. There are situations where they don't. And it's interesting to think about what goes wrong in those situations. I actually do have some slides prepared on that, but I won't have time to get to them, I think. But you can ask me about that at the end if you're curious. One interesting point that can be made though, is that there's something that happens for global symmetries that can't happen here, which is that subsystem symmetries cannot permute anyon type. So it's possible to make a very simple argument that there's no way for a subsystem symmetry to permute anyons. We don't have to worry about that possibility, but that's not a sufficient condition for localizations of the symmetry to exist. There are cases where a subsystem symmetry doesn't permute anyons, but still these localizations fail to exist. Okay, and we have some understanding of that. Let's move on. We'll assume these localizations exist, and we can try to revisit this no-go argument. Okay, so let's pick the simplest relation we have really in this theory, where we square two row generators and we get the identity. Okay, so the localized version of that relation is going to be an operator V of R that's just supported on these two points in the boundary region. Okay, it's only supported in these two points, and we right away see that there's no way to assign an abelian anyon string operator to this relation, because such an operator has support everywhere running along the boundary of del R, but this operator is only supported at two points. Well, you can assign a string operator to it, but it has to be the trivial string, because the trivial string is an identity operator, so that's okay. And another point, so that sort of suggests that the fractionalization of this relation is trivial. You can make a different argument, which leads to the same conclusion. You can ask, well, what if an anyon sits inside this region? Can this relation act on it in a non-trivial way? And that's what this picture is about. And the answer is no, because you can always choose the string operator for an anyon that sits inside this region to avoid the support. To avoid these two red disks where V of R is supported. And so in fact, the anyon string operator has to commute with this localized symmetry. And so there can be no non-trivial symmetry fractionalization on this anyon. So we conclude that the fractionalization of this relation is trivial, okay? And so this is sort of a somewhat more formal, maybe fancier version of the same no-go argument that I gave you at the beginning of the talk. And you can apply this argument to all of these relations that are listed here, including the relations that tell you that the row and column generators or two row generators commute. Okay, so very similar arguments give you the same conclusion in all of those cases. And so we call those relations non-fractionalizable relations. There's no symmetry fractionalization associated with them. Okay, however, there's one more relation which is not covered by these arguments. And in fact, the no-go argument doesn't work in the case of this relation, okay? And that's the global relation, which I said would play an important role, right? So if you draw a picture of what the operators in this relation look like before you truncate them, you just get a grid of horizontal and vertical lines. And of course, this is just the identity operator because, really every time a horizontal and a vertical line cross, they cancel out. Okay, to study the symmetry fractionalization of this relation, what you do is you take the localized versions of all of the row generators and all of the column generators for some region R, and then you take a product of all of those, and in the interior of that region, you get the identity, but now you have these red dots running along the boundary where those row and column generators can be non-trivial. And that runs along the whole boundary. So you can think of that as some kind of a string operator running along the whole boundary. So it's possible, at least in principle, for this to be the string operator of some non-trivial abelian anyon. And so if you can find a model where that actually happens, then you would show that actually this global relation can be fractionalized. Okay. So this argument doesn't tell you that this non-trivial fractionalization necessarily happens. It just tells you that it just really just shows that it looks like there's room for it within the general framework. And to go one step further and show that this actually happens, the best way to do that is just to exhibit a model. And that's what I'm going to do next. But before I do that, I want to make some comments which if they don't mean much to you, you can ignore them because the rest of the talk won't depend on it. I just want to make some comments on the mathematical structure of symmetry fractionalization that comes out of the above arguments, because it's different from the mathematical structure for ordinary symmetry fractionalization. And I still find this a little puzzling, and I suspect that there's more to understand about this. So what the above arguments do is because there are many non-fractionalizable relations, they actually determine a subgroup of two co-cycles with coefficients in the group of abelian anions. Okay, so there's a subgroup of allowed two co-cycles. Okay, and then there's a further thing that happens, which is that no co-boundary transformations are allowed, right? Before we had this ambiguity of the symmetries where symmetry localizations where we multiplied them by an anion string. But for subsystem symmetry, we're not allowed to do that because that would change the support of our localized symmetry operators. So there actually is no ambiguity at all. And we're not allowed to make any co-boundary transformations. And so the conclusion is that actually symmetry fractionalization is not characterized by a cohomology class in this cohomology group. If it's, to the extent that this mathematical framework is even useful here, it suggests that what actually characterizes symmetry fractionalization is a certain subgroup of two co-cycles, which from a mathematical point of view is actually not very appealing. And I'm sure there's more to say about this because you can also ask about symmetries that combine global symmetry and subsystem symmetry. And I don't know what happens in that case. We haven't thought about those examples.
For the global relation, why can I not attach additional string?
But the global relation is something that you get taking a product of the individual generators. So the generators themselves are not ambiguous. So, right, like the symmetry, it's the global relation is constructed out of these symmetry localizations V for the row and column symmetries, right? So this is really the definition of what the global relation is, but these operators are not ambiguous. You can't multiply them by an anion string. So there's really no sense in which you can and you certainly cannot just take relations and multiply them by anion strings, because if you could do that, that's never allowed, because that actually changes the kind of symmetry fractionalization you have. So you're allowed to modify these operators for group elements, but in the subsystem symmetry, these can't be modified, right? So this operator is a product of operators that have no ambiguity in them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. So in the last, 10 minutes, since we started 5 minutes late, I just want to tell you, I want to tell you about a model where all of these phenomena actually occur. And it's quite a simple model. It's really just a souped up version of the toric code on the square lattice, where in addition to the usual edge qubits, we also have a qubit on each vertex. Okay. And so the Hamiltonian is a sum of three kinds of terms, two terms centered on vertices and one term is centered on plaquettes of the square lattice. So the plaquette term is just a product of Pauli X operators on the four edges of this square, as well as the X operators on the four vertices. And there are two kinds of vertex terms, and each one involves a Pauli Z operator on the corresponding vertex, and then that's producted with two Pauli Zs on neighboring edges, either horizontal edges or vertical edges. So you get these two kind of vertex terms. I observed that if you take a product of this X vertex operator with a Y vertex operator, you get the vertex operator of the standard toric code model. So these terms all commute with one another. This is a solvable stabilizer code. It's very easy to answer any question about this model that you want to, just like for the toric code itself. And one important property of this model is that there is a finite depth circuit, which does not respect the subsystem symmetry that I'll tell you about in a second. So it's a symmetry non-respecting circuit, but it's a local circuit that disentangles this model to the standard toric code plus a trivial system on the vertex qubits. And what that tells us is that this system really has the topological order of the toric code. So if we ignore any symmetries that are present, there's nothing going on in this model beyond just the usual toric code topological order. And we can use that disentangling map to identify or to label excitations of this model in terms of excitations of the toric code. And what we see is that we expect to be able to find E and M excitations, okay? So and what you call E and what you call M is arbitrary, but I'll make a choice. So the M particles are plaquette excitations where the eigenvalue of this BP operator is -1. So you can think of them as living on plaquettes. And there are two flavors of E particles. And you can make E particles by exciting one of the vertex terms, but not the other one. So you can excite the X vertex term, but not the Y one at some point, or you can do it the other way around. And those are two different kinds of E particles, which you can think of, which I'll call EX and EY, which you can think of as living at this vertex. And there's also a local excitation that you can make where you excite both vertex terms at a given point. Okay, so that is just a trivial excitation. From the point of view of topological order, some local excitation. And you can make that just by acting with a Pauli X operator on a single vertex. Okay, so, all right, now this model, I'll come back to the properties of these excitations in a little bit. But first I wanna say that, this model has a natural subsystem symmetry that we can impose. Of course, this solvable stabilizer code model has a huge amount of symmetry because every term in the Hamiltonian you can think of as a symmetry operator. We want to impose some symmetry and then we were interested in properties that would persist even when we make the model generic while imposing that symmetry. So the symmetry that we want to impose is a linear Z2 subsystem symmetry, and it's exactly the same kind of symmetry I introduced earlier. And we get this symmetry just by taking products of Pauli Zs on rows and columns. And we only use the vertex qubits to do that. So it doesn't involve the edge qubits at all. Okay. And because the row generators and column generators are using the same vertex qubits, this global relation is satisfied, right? Because if we take a product of all the row generators, then we just get a product of vertex Z everywhere. And same thing if we take a product of all the column generators. Okay, so this global relation is satisfied in this model. And one thing to mention is that this local excitation is an excitation which is charged under a single row generator and under a single column generator. Okay, so these are sort of the elementary local charged excitations of this subsystem symmetry. Okay, now we can construct localized versions of this symmetry. And the way to do that is you just truncate one of these symmetries and you first ask, what kind of excitation does this truncated symmetry operator create? Acting with the single vertex Z creates four M particles on the four plaquettes touching that vertex. And so acting with this truncated operator, if you didn't do anything else, it will create pairs of M particles on the ends. But a pair of M particles can be cleaned up by acting with a single edge Z. Okay, so we can use that to write down this localized version of the row symmetry operator. It looks like this. And this is really an operator that doesn't create any excitations out of a ground state it doesn't create any excitations in this boundary region if you start with the localizable state. And for the column symmetries, it looks the same. You just decorate them with this, with these extra edge Zs, okay. And so now once you have those operators, you can just ask about the fractionalization of the global relation. And in this kind of simple stabilizer code context, you can just do the calculation. You just take a product of all of the row and column generators within whatever region you're interested in. And the vertex Zs on the interior cancel out, but these edge Zs going slightly outside the region are left behind, okay? And these edge Zs they actually just form a string operator for a M particle, okay? So the M excitations, just like in the ordinary toric code, the string operators for M excitations are just these products of edge z's associated with curves in the dual lattice. Okay, so we do get some non-trivial anyon string operator from this localized global relation. And so what does that tell us? Well, this is the string operator for an M excitation, for an M particle. And so what that tells us is that the symmetry will act non-trivially on E excitations sitting inside this region. And in particular, right, one way to interpret this global relation, I guess it's not here it's written, right? So this global relation tells us, one way to think about it, it tells us that any excitation is charged, has to be, any local excitation has to be charged under an even number of row plus column generators, because the total row plus column charge has to cancel out and give you no net charge, okay? But what it means for this symmetry to be fractionalized is that the E particles actually will be charged under an odd number of row plus column generators, which is not possible for local excitations. And the very simplest thing that can happen, which is a charge assignment, which is kind of the reasonable one to make for the elementary EX and EY excitations in this model, is that the E excitations are each charged under either a single row generator or under a single column generator. Okay, but that's not a charge assignment that's possible for local excitations, trivial excitations in this model. And there's a simple consequence of that, right? So the EX excitations are, they carry charge under a single row generator of the symmetry, but under nothing else. And that allows them to move horizontally under dynamics that respect the symmetry, right? Because they can maintain that charge and still move anywhere they want within their given row. They can't move perpendicular to the row without changing their charge, though, because if an excitation lives off of that row, it couldn't be charged under the same row generator anymore. Okay. So what this means is that these EX and EY excitations are actually symmetry enforced line-ons. They can only move in rows and in columns under dynamics that respect the symmetry. And indeed, it's very easy to see that if you just play around with the model. And in fact, that was the first thing that we noticed before we realized that this had anything to do with symmetry fractionalization. You can just immediately see this from the model. So you can ask, is there any way for an EX excitation to move vertically? And in order to do that, it would need to turn a corner. And so you could imagine that it can move to the right and turn into an EY somehow. And that should be possible as a local process, and then move off vertically. But the point is that this corner turning requires inserting some charge under the subsystem symmetry. So this is actually exactly what you get if you take EX and you bind it with one of these local excitations, which carries charge under both a row and a column generator. So you can do this process, but you can't do it under dynamics that respect the subsystem symmetry. And so in fact, the string operator that would implement this process would fail to commute with some of the subsystem symmetry generators. So if you break the symmetry, and that is sort of what you expect, because if you break the symmetry, these E excitations should be able to move freely anywhere. There shouldn't be anything more than just the toric code topological order once you explicitly break this symmetry. Okay. All right. Good. Okay. So the last thing I want to say about this is if you just look at these phenomena, you might think like this doesn't really look like phenomena that you would usually think of as associated with symmetry fractionalization. But this kind of restricted mobility really should be thought of as a kind of symmetry fractionalization. And one way to see that is that, these phenomena go along with the property that there's no way to take a local excitation and bind it to an EX particle and give you an excitation which carries no charge under the subsystem symmetry, right? An excitation that's uncharged under the subsystem symmetry would be fully mobile. But these EX and EY excitations are non-neutralizable. There's no way to bind local excitations to them and make them local. And non-neutralizability is maybe the simplest property that you can have to say that there's non-trivial symmetry fractionalization in some model, quite generally, right? For example, You can't take a Laughlin quasiparticle and bind electrons to it and get something charge neutral. You can't take a spin a half spin on and bind spin one magnons to it and get something that doesn't carry any spin. So this is really just another version of this non-neutralizability property, but for a more sophisticated or subtle kind of symmetry.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
I think you mentioned to construct the localized version of the symmetry on the E excitation, we have some freedom. It can either be a single row or column, or I guess it can also be say three columns or three rows. Does this change anything?
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. I mean, it's true that, so for example, so in this solvable model, the freedom, there is a freedom in constructing these localizations. And, you know, you can always take, and the way to understand that freedom is you can take one of these localizations that I drew, and you can multiply this by some stabilizer near one of these regions. So you're always allowed to do that. So you can pretty easily see that, I mean, so that's a freedom that you're allowed, but it won't change, but it's not going to change the fact that you have an M string operator running along the boundary, right? Because all you would be doing is taking this M string and multiplying it by stabilizers in certain positions. So you can't change the fact that there's an M string operator running all the way around the boundary.
And this is enough to ensure that E has the symmetry enforced mobility?
Yeah, that's right. Because the fact that, so what the symmetry fractionalization tells you, I think maybe this is what you were asking about. So E particle has to be charged under an odd number of row plus column generators. But there are many, many different kinds of E particles, right? The simplest one would be an E particle that's just charged under a single row generator, say, but you can always bind local excitations to that. And you could get an E particle, which is charged under one row generator and two column generators, for example, and that's allowed. That kind of excitation is actually not mobile. It's kind of a symmetry enforced fracton. But there are many different kinds of E particles with different mobilities. But in this model, it turns out that the elementary ones are these symmetry enforced line-ons. And even in a more general model, there is somewhere in the spectrum would have to be the symmetry enforced line-ons, although they might not always be the simplest or lowest energy excitations that you could make in a particular model.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Taylor has a question.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for the nice talk. I may have missed it, but is there any hope that this can be generalized to dipolar symmetries as opposed to subsystem?
I have not yet tried to think about that. That's a good question. I think it would be a good thing to think about. I think that the sort of general framework and philosophy is something that can be applied to dipolar symmetries. If I think about it very naively, it sort of seems like I wouldn't get something very different. Like if I had a U1 dipolar symmetry or something like that, it kind of feels like I would get something not very different than if I just had an ordinary U1 symmetry. But I haven't thought about it carefully. You know, the reason it doesn't feel very different is that if you take a dipolar symmetry and you restrict it to a patch, you still get a symmetry that's supported everywhere on the patch, including, and you had to cut it everywhere on the boundary in order to do that. And here the key differences from ordinary global symmetries came from the fact that you're only cutting the symmetry kind of in a few places on the boundary rather than everywhere along the boundary. But I think there should be things that are different for dipolar symmetries, and there ought to be a way of seeing that with similar pictures, but it might require more thought.
Okay, great, thank you.
Good, yeah, so I mean, this is a good place to wrap up. I think, let me not talk about this, but I'll just leave you with a little bit of a summary and some outlook. So I told you that subsystem symmetry can indeed fractionalize on point particles, and you know, the main phenomenon that comes out of that is some constraints on mobility of excitations in the presence of symmetry. And there are still a lot of other questions that come out of this that, in fact, my collaborators and I are thinking about. So you might ask, are there kinds of subsystem symmetry fractionalization that are possible, but only on the boundary of some suitable 3D SSPT phase? And we don't know yet if that can happen. It's also interesting to think about what can happen in three dimensions, where the structure of both of symmetries and of the kinds of excitations that you have in topological order is richer. So there's, you know, there's a lot to explore there, I think. And this last point here, it would take a couple minutes to explain what this question is about. So maybe I'll just leave that up there. And if someone cares to know more, you can ask about it. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mike, for the very interesting talk. Are there questions from the audience?
I have one more question.
Sure.
So what's the simple argument that says subsystem symmetry cannot permute anions?
So let me try to, let me see. Maybe I can, it's maybe helpful to draw a picture. So let me share my iPad screen and then I can draw a picture. All right, that should work. There we go. So imagine that we have a state psi with some anion A in it, right? So this is our anion A. And let's imagine that we have a subsystem symmetry S that acts on a line where this anion sits. And so let's assume that if we act, so this is a pic, on the top here is a picture of this state psi. And on the bottom, so let's assume that if we act on this anion A, we'll get a B anion if we act on it with the subsystem symmetry. Okay, so now, and I shouldn't have used S actually, because I want to use S for something else. Let's call this U instead, U. So now, since this is a mobile point particle, there is some operator S. So now I want to draw a picture of a different state, S psi. Okay, this is where the symmetry acts. This is where the anion used to sit. This is S. There's some operator S that you can use to, and it's more or less a local operator. You can use it to move this anion off the line. Okay. And here you still have an A anion. And so then what you want to do is you want to compare two states. And so let me see if I can remember how this goes. What you want to do is you want to look at the state US psi, okay, right, and you want to compare that with the state U. Well, okay, so this is equal to this state. Here we go. Yeah, this is the argument that we want. Right. So this is a state that starts out with an A anion. Okay. So S psi has an A anion, and actually US psi still has an A anion, because if you act with the symmetry here, it doesn't act on this anion, so it can't permute it. So this state definitely has an A anion. Okay, but the following identity here is true. Okay, right? You can just multiply by U inverse and U. This operator is local in the sense that, you know, if we draw some big region around here, right? S is local in this sense. So this operator is also local because U is some kind of local unitary. This state, U psi, by assumption, has a B anion. But this is a contradiction because now we have this state with a B anion and we're acting on it with a local operator, and we have a state with an A anion. So that can't happen. That's the argument. I don't know if I explained it very clearly, but it's in an appendix of our paper if you want to spend more time with it to make sure that you buy it. That's the argument.
Thanks.
So I have one question. So in 3D, do you expect to have more relations that can fractionalize?
Yeah, and even in 2D, actually, you can have symmetries with more than one global relation. So for example, one of the examples that we study in our paper is a symmetry where you have row and column and diagonal symmetries. And so in that case, there are actually, you could say that there are, you know, there are different, and there are different kinds of symmetries like that you can have, but the example we look at has two independent global relations. And going along with that, there are more types of symmetry fractionalization. And indeed, it's also true as you go up in dimension, it's natural to have more and more of those relations. Because if you think, for example, about like a planar symmetry in three dimensions, then there are three orientations of planes. And so even exactly the analog of this Z2 line symmetry in three dimensions is a planar symmetry, where again, there are in some sense three global relations, but actually one of them is not independent of the others. So there are two independent global relations. So yeah, it seems like you can probably have a pretty rich structure of global relations.
Yeah.
And that leads to more interesting patterns of symmetry fractionalization.
How about the cases where support of subsystem symmetries kind of have some fractal structures?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So we also studied that a little bit, at least in one example. So it is possible. So there's a version of this. So this story you can also apply when you have fractal symmetries. We found a model where there is a fractal symmetry that is non-trivially fractionalized. There are some subtleties though. One subtlety is that it's harder to see with fractal symmetries what the relations might be. There's another subtlety, which is sort of not so obvious a priori, which at least happens in this particular model, which is that if you, so one thing that can happen in general with subsystem symmetry is that you can take your symmetry operator and truncate it. And your truncated symmetry operator might create some anions on the boundary. But for example, suppose you have a line symmetry and you truncate that, it could create a pair of anions at the two endpoints. So that's an example of a symmetry that can't be localized. The claim I would make is you should think of that as an example of a symmetry that's broken. It's actually quite analogous to broken one-form symmetry. And in that particular example, you can actually get that from a broken one-form symmetry. With fractal symmetry, at least in the model that we studied, the same kind of thing happens. If you take one of the generators for a fractal symmetry and you cut it, you wind up with some M excitations that are created at discrete points on the boundary. And there's no way to locally clean those excitations up. But then there's a trick, which is that you can take a smaller symmetry, which is generated by pairs of fractal generators. And that symmetry is unbroken, and it also satisfies a global relation, because if you take a product over all the pairs, then you get one. And so that relation actually can be fractionalized. It's with fractal symmetry, I feel like my understanding, even just of what kinds of symmetries are possible, and the structure of global relations you can have is not, I don't really understand in general how that works. We have an example which is worked out in the paper where we understand enough about that to say some things.
So these relations between symmetries, like figuring out a path, non-trivial path in the space of symmetry operation, that some kind of non-trivial closed path, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Yeah. Yeah. You can formulate this. I don't think that this story needs to be formulated in terms of generators and relations, but it's very hard to work with subsystem symmetries, but subsystem symmetries are hard to work with unless you formulate them in terms of generators and relations. Like, I think there's a, you know, you can formulate a lot of these things just I don't think generators and relations are actually required for any of this. You can just talk about the abstract group structure. But that would not be very suitable for actually calculating anything for these symmetries.
Okay. Are there more questions?
Can I ask one clarifying question? Maybe I didn't follow the argument about that you can't convert anyon types using this symmetry. So the cartoon picture you drew was similar to the cartoon picture you were drawing early, and there was a loophole that you could not, in the sense that, could it be that you can't move the anyon off that line because of some mobility restriction?
Yeah, so, right. So you, right. So that, yeah, that's a great question. So, right. You can, what you can, so I would claim, no, I think there's not a loophole in this argument. Let me bring that picture back. And one way to kind of try to answer that is to ask, like, what was wrong with this first version of the no-go argument. So what's wrong with it is that one doesn't really recognize or call attention to the fact that the operator that you use to move the anyon off the line might transform under the symmetry. Because for subsystem symmetry, you have to worry about that. And indeed, that's exactly what happens in the models that have non-trivial subsystem symmetry fractionalization. So you have an anyon that sits on some line, and the only way to move it off that line is to act with an operator that doesn't commute with the symmetry. And so then once you realize that, it's very subtle to actually draw any conclusions about how symmetry can act on anyons just by making an argument like that. But here, in this argument, it doesn't, you know, this operator that moves the anyon off the line may be acted on non-trivially by the symmetry. It doesn't matter. The argument still works, right? In fact, the only thing we rely on is that this operator is locally, but that's always going to be true.
Yeah.
So this is a solid argument, right, in general.
Right. This is much more a topological argument, in the sense that this is more constraint, which is more general in some sense.
Right. Yeah. And it's also, I mean, it also makes sense that another more vague thing one can say is that, like, you know, this anyon permuting phenomena are somehow like more robust and easier to diagnose than these phenomena of fractional quantum numbers. So it kind of makes sense to me that a very simple argument would work here, whereas in the, you know, for fractional quantum numbers, you might need something more sophisticated to be confident that you've got it right.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you.